The Visioneers, Episode 2. Enter the Visioneers.
And now, where were we? You had told us about the wonderful metaphor of the wave, and we were riding the wave, and then we found on the top of the Rocky Mountains, on a beautiful grassy hillside, a log cabin, and inside was our thinking room, a place of peace and magic. And from there, we met the mentors, and you then took us on a sweep of the earth. And so, where have we come now? Take the story on, Des. Let's go.
Well, the mentors have been waiting for you, and back you. So you're back now in the thinking room, and there's Churchill and all of the others. And Churchill proposes a new project for humanity. And Kennedy suggests that what we'll need to do is to gather a team of key people to lead it. And this will be the Visioneers. And so a lively debate now begins between all of the mentors as to who should be included in the team. And Kennedy, of course, wants a political leader and practical people like engineers and architects and so on. Churchill wants a military man and a journalist and a historian, sounds a bit like himself. And Dickens, of course, wants a poet and a teacher, a man of the cloth, a performer and an artist. And Anne comes in wanting young people and a mother. And then you make your own contribution, suggesting there should be a farmer and a scientist and someone from an Aboriginal culture. And then it's Dickens who pulls it all together in a marvelous summary of these people. He uses his creative imagination, and here they come. Hurrah for our team of visioneers, he says. Can't you just see them assembling, getting ready for the work? There's old Mutsu Sandu, president of Urari in Africa, with his black smiling face, and little Miss Henshaw peeping over her glasses just fresh out of her schoolroom in Aberdeen. General Soulier, with his full chest of military ribbons from Paris, extols the virtue of military discipline to Mark Venture, head of Venture Engineering in Brisbane, Australia. Carl Ibsen, the Norwegian architect, is discussing Gothic architecture with Jeremy Hiscox, a reader in history at Cambridge, England. Then there's little Sally Hurst, high school student from Auckland, New Zealand, meeting her pen pal Nicholas Andropov from Moscow for the first time. The Welsh poet, Daniel Thomas, has a rapt audience for his oratory. Boris Gunther, dairy farmer from the Rhine Valley, Junichi Yakasawa, president of Yakasawa Incorporated, Tokyo, Carmen Santander, dark-eyed Spanish singer and dancer, William Bates, publisher of New World Press from Los Angeles, and George Cardinal, chief of the Red Earth Band in northern Alberta, Canada. Now add to this Teresa Romano, mother of two sons and three daughters from Naples, Esther Fisher, Israeli artist from Tel Aviv, Lin Yuan, senior secretary in the People's Republic of China, Mohammed Hussein from Jordan and head of a project planning commission at the United Nations headquarters in New York, Indira Murthy, biologist from New Delhi, and Father Luis Valdez from San Diego. Now, here we have a full assembly of Earth people, which, for a Victorian novelist from London, shows a grand stretch of the imagination, don't you think? Would that I could have included them in my circle, along with my David Copperfields and Martin Chuzzlewits and Sam Pickwicks. It was a different time, and as fertile as I found my garden then, the human landscape of the 21st century is so much richer that my spirit soars with the sense of what we can do together on this project. My friends, it's a grand endeavor. God bless us in its pursuit and its accomplishment.
Well, now the exciting part comes, the arrival of the Visioneers, and you bring them in full flood with your creative imagination, and so I'd like to read to you how that happens. They arrive by Silver Bridge. Suddenly, the sky changes color to the soft pinks of daybreak, then to deep purple of grapes and royal robes, and you're moving in on the Silver Bridge across the sky, watching it change color now to emerald green and lilac, a whole kaleidoscope of different hues and patterns, enveloping you, washing over you, calming your spirits, quieting your mind. It's warm and sunny. The sky is blue again, and you step off the Silver Bridge onto the grassy slopes beside your mountain retreat. Adjoining the building, a is a new structure of log and Blue Mountain stone, stretching expansively across the slope, tucked among tall ancient spruce and pine trees, looking out across a vista of open grassy hillside, mountain ranges, and the deep valley with its amethyst blue lakes sparkling in the sunlight in the valley below. You turn and look up into the sky, where the silver bridge stretches away until it fades from view. As you watch, something changes, slowly materializing out of the blue haze, some darker outline of figures on the bridge moving towards you, gliding effortlessly on the moving sidewalk, growing larger as they come. The lead figure is almost at the end of the bridge now, where it touches the grassy slope between two tall pillars of shining silver. He steps off. You recognize him instantly from Charles Dickens' description. Tall, black, smiling, friendly round face, silver hair, wearing cool white African robes flowing easily over his ample frame. President Mutsando from Yarari. And behind him, one after another they come, stepping off the bridge, gathering on the hillside, greeting each other, smiling, shaking hands, embracing, their voices and laughter drifting up to you. You see them clearly. Men in casual summer shirts and slacks, women in bright colors, many nationalities, about 20 in all, younger faces and older, various shades of white, suntanned, black and brown, all smiling, looking refreshed, relaxed, and expectant for adventure. This is your company of visioneers, arrived from across the earth, assembled, eager, ready to begin, waiting for you to join them to design the new project for the human family, for the earth, and for all life on it. And now, Des, can you describe the place where they meet, the visioneering room?
Yes, well, this is going to be a key place throughout the story from here on in. It's a site of much activity to come. Here it is. In an instant, the scene has changed, and the new arrivals are assembled in a large round room of the visioneering complex. It's full of light from the bank of windows around the perimeter and from the huge glass dome above that opens the interior to the sky. The visioneers have all found places around a continuous circular desk of richly polished wood, light-grained and pleasant to touch. The desk is one of several arranged in concentric circles, open at the front and rising in tiers above floor level, where there is an open space about 15 meters across. In this space, in full view of all participants, a huge world globe slowly turns, glowing iridescent, showing continents, oceans, islands in full earth tones of brown and green and gold and blue. There are no boundaries or names, only the continuous natural features of the living earth. As you look more closely, you realize that this globe is not solid. Rather, it's a three-dimensional image, a hologram projected into the center of the room, visible to everyone as if solid, but existing only as an image. The remainder of the floor is clear, carpeted in light blue and white, a mirror image of the sky visible through the dome above. The visioneers sit in comfortable high-backed white leather chairs that turn to allow them quiet conversation with their neighbors, while at the same time providing a full 360-degree view of everything around. This is the visioneering room, heart of the complex you've created to fashion a rich and meaningful future for the world.
And now we can begin to meet the visioneers. We can get to know them through what they say, through their wide-ranging conversation. We begin with Mutsando, president of Yarari, a mythical country in Africa. He laments his people and his country are lost, looking at the rich world and wanting that, but confused, partly wanting to go, partly feeling just lost.
And contrasted with that, then, we get the world of Bill Bates. Now, Bill Bates is a newspaper man, comes from Los Angeles, and you couldn't imagine anything in a more marked contrast with Yarari. Now we get an interesting feature of the visioneering room, because as Bill talks, we get the image of what he's talking about coming up in the center of the room, replacing the globe. And so he comes from a world of cocoons, people cocooned in their cars and their tall buildings, and all around them the smog of Los Angeles. And we see this in the room. And Bill makes the point that people are working hard, beavering away there, and then escaping. And where do they escape to? They escape to places like Urari. And then what do they want to do? They want to get back again, back into that pell-mell activity of Los Angeles. And there never seems to be enough time to think about why they're doing this and what it all means. And this gives a lead then to Indira Murthy, who you'll remember comes from India. And she's a biologist, and she brings a different, more reflective perspective. Jerry, why don't you read this piece?
So Indira is speaking softly. She says, "We have created a world of great activity, but very little reflection." She smiles almost shyly, a tiny figure in a magnificent coral pink sari. She's young, no more than 35 at most. But her deep brown eyes and relaxed feature bring a sense of wisdom to her years. She continues, "In the race for techniques and profits, people have forgotten that their conscious human minds are part of the universal consciousness, which includes the Earth, our mother. By seeing themselves separate from the Earth, people are using their living energy to run in conflict with the universal life force. It is very destructive, both to the individual and the Earth. We need to learn again that all reality is energy. In the beginning it was energy, in time it coalesced into matter, but the energy remained locked inside, and when human consciousness came into the world, it came as energy, able to touch the inner parts of reality and set itself in harmony with that energy. But human consciousness also has the power of analytic inquiry, to probe, as it were, from the outside, to discover bit by bit the complexity of the whole, but never, never in this way to be able to touch, let alone understand, the universal energy that runs through everything."
Well, now this again gives us a marked contrast with the next speaker, who is Mark Venter from Australia. And he brings a practical and forceful perspective. This is Mark Venter. "Well put, Indira. That's very powerful." His Australian accent is pleasant and friendly. He's a tall, well-built, good-looking man with suntanned face and twinkling blue eyes. As he speaks, he places his large, strong hands in front of him, slowly locking and unlocking his fingers. "What you're saying is that we've bought into a way of thinking and acting that's no longer good for us. Is that right?" Many heads around the table nod. "But built into our brains, or is it in our minds? Anyway, somewhere in our mental faculties, we can get inspiration to see things differently. Not to accept, for example, that the only way to make newsprint is to cut down our forests, or the only way to grow food is to pour fertilizer into the soil." And so Mark then continues, and he talks about building because he's an engineer, and he understands that before you can build, you have to see it. You have to see it in your mind. And now this provides an opening for Esther Fisher, and we see here the beginning of a connection between these two, and a perceptive observer will say, aha, there's something going on here. Esther comes from Israel, and I'll read her description from the book. "She is small, but her presence glows with strong energy as she leans forward in her high-backed leather chair. The same spirit shines in the rearing white unicorn with golden horn which decorates her soft pink sweater. Her curly auburn hair frames the delicate features of her face, which, without makeup, glows fresh with healthy beauty." Esther is an artist. And Jerry, why don't you read what Esther says about the process of creation?
"Yes, I will," she says. "Every artist knows that vision is the first part of creation. Before I begin a painting, I must feel the energy of what I want to paint, filling the whole space around me. It's as if I'm part of it and it's part of me. And then, slowly out of the energy field, emerges with great clarity the image I want to create. It's there in every detail. I can see it, every part of it, every brushstroke, every splash of color, separate and merging with the other colors to create something greater than all the others, a synergy of all the parts, a composite, coming right out of the mind onto the canvas. Can we here together create and fashion a similar vision for the world? The future is in our minds. Can we begin here in this room to see it? Can we clear our minds of all the bitterness, the old truths that don't serve us well, the evil that intrudes like a dark cancer growing to choke out the life when it's first destroyed? I think we can do that. I know we can do it. And if we can do it here, then we can find a way to take it out to the world. And that would be a wonderful thing to do. Don't you think so? Her voice, her question, hangs quietly in the air as every mind considers and searches for the response. Mark Venture's glance meets hers. Something passes between them, almost imperceptible, just a fleeting contact, but a connection nonetheless. When he speaks, the words are for the room, but the intent is for Esther.
There. I told you there was going to be a connection between these two. Well, now Mark continues speaking and waxes eloquent in his own Australian way. He talks about leadership and about being lost out back of Burke in the broken-down truck, and where the thing that you need to pull you through is vision. Vision to see where you have to go and vision to take you there. And this brings in the idea of Moses. And no doubt that's the influence of Esther already occurring. And the idea here of having to give up what you have in order to search for the promised land. And then he links that to the predicament of the planet. What does everyone on planet Earth need to make it through into a decent future? We need knowledge about where we are right now. We need to put our brains to work to see where we're going to be in a few short years if we don't do something different from what we're doing now. We need to get a vision of what something better can be, and we need to commit every bit of our energy to making that vision happen. We're all leaders and followers at the same time. We have to be good at both and be able to tell when we need to be one or the other. And I suppose that's the definition of a visioneer. Someone who's able to engineer a preferred future by being a good leader and a good follower. That's who we are, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the band of visioneers.
Well, Mark's enthusiasm sparks something more volatile from Teresa Romano, a kind of latent passion, and her motherly affection and great fondness for hugging, which she does throughout the story, emerges here, and she starts with Mark's. You can just imagine that in your mind's eye. And her entry into the conversation triggers one of the most memorable images of the book, and I'll read it for you now. On his other side, the other side of Mark, is Teresa Romano, short, well-rounded, mother of five from Naples. And so she lifts him from his chair and hugs him into the folds of her ample body. Oh, you're so right. Her voice is deep and rich with the passion of the Mediterranean. We are the visioneers. But it's not just for us, the vision. It's for the world, and most of all, for the children. I have five of them at home in Naples, my little ones. I have their photographs. And she fusses around inside a huge black leather handbag looking for the photographs. But there's no need. In an instant, the children are in the room, center stage, running through the narrow cobblestone streets of Naples, two boys and three girls, age 5 to 15. The little one, Maria, black-haired and pink-frocked, running hard with little legs, hand in hand with brother Stefano the eldest, who almost tugs her off her feet as they run, hard, shouting and laughing. And out of the doorways of the other houses pour more children, dodging under clothes hanging on sagging lines across the street, running, just running hard, faces alive with youth, their voices shouting, filling the room until the whole center space is filled with children from every land, eyes glowing, eager, passionate, full of fun and laughter. They've left the streets of Naples and are thronging into an open field filled with sunshine and green grass. Stefano appears again, now with little Maria on his shoulders. He's waving a large blue flag, held high on a long pole, sky blue, with a large white circle at the center of it, representing the world, and in the circle, a huge white V for Visioneers. Little Maria carries her own small flag, waving it furiously, and suddenly all of the children have flags, and it's a dancing sea of blue with bold white V waving high and free as the children weave and dance around the field, then thread out into a long line with Stefano and Maria in the lead, and head off down the winding tree-lined road singing. Their voices float up and fill the room where the Visioneers are sitting transfixed by the spectacle. Until the children are gone, and all that remains are their voices, and the song, and the words, repeating over and over again,
"We are the ones going to the fore, big ones, little ones, all of us are here, small world, big world, reaching out to all, up, up, and upmost, the mighty Visioneers."
And from here the scene moves rapidly to a close, with several others speaking, and finally at the end we eavesdrop on a conversation between Muhammad Hussein and Lin Yuan, each of them from a great culture, and each of them wondering about how that culture will serve them in the future. And indeed, these are prophetic words for all of the Visioneers in the room, because little do they know, at this time, the extent to which each of them will soon be tested and how deeply they will have to search in and beyond their traditions to find the way ahead. The conversation continues as the sun drops slowly behind the mountains and long shadows creep across the landscape.
You have met your band of Visioneers, and they have learned a little of each other. Brought together in the mindscape of your imagination, they've come upon the stage where now they'll start to play out the drama of a time between time, before the end and the beginning. You don't know where this will take either you or them. You sense only that this must happen, and that you'll see it through the duration when your part in it will be done. For now, you can enjoy the company of your friends and accept your role as mentor and student of the experience.
Yes, indeed. We've now met the Visioneers, and the mentors have been watching all of this. And when you go back to the thinking room, there's a lively session in which they all talk about these people. Churchill is full of judgments, but he's impressed by Mark Venture and Esther Fisher in particular. And now he raises the idea of empires of the mind as being the important powers of the future. But Kennedy doesn't like that phrase too much. He prefers the concept of what he calls a we future, a time of holistic and entrepreneurial enterprise, where cooperation is the essential thing. But Churchill presses his point, and he talks about changing the global mindscape and moving towards planetary stewardship. And this is what he says. "The nation-state is an imperfect concept. It is at best a stepping stone to the place where we now must go, planetary stewardship. And we can't get there unless we turn 5.5 billion minds from a multitude of cultural ignorances into a unified mind frame. They must see that human fellowship in union with the life systems of the planet is the only possible way for a decent future life. Creating that mindscape is the momentous task of our band of Visioneers. Seeking out the pressure points and touching them to move the power levers of politics and wealth and military might with a new and more powerful force, enlightened vision of human destiny. That's the object of our efforts, my friends. That's the mission of our Visioneers."
Well, now he introduces a major theme of the story, the idea of creating a Congress of Global Mind. And he does this rather dramatically, and I'd like to read it to you right now. Churchill strides across the room to the bookcase, lifts down a large, heavy, brass-bound globe of the world, and sets it spinning on a coffee table in front of the fireplace. John Kennedy and Charles Dickens are both watching and listening attentively, each appreciating the high-order performance of a master statesman.
That, says Churchill, gesturing to the spinning globe, is in peril. We must save it.
He puts his hand firmly on the globe and stops the spin. We begin by sending our emissaries to strategic pressure points throughout to stir minds to act.
Here, 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 and here.
He stabs his finger into various parts of the world.
The exact locations don't concern us now. I'll outline them in due course. That's step one. Step two calls for a grand assembly of world leaders. And mind, I'm not talking here of the posturing apology for power broking that goes on in the United Nations in New York. That's a patchwork affair, already an anachronism of past mind frame of warring combatants grabbing for territory and control. No, I'm talking here of a Congress of the Global Mind, where the central task is creative, not defensive. To build with the full energy of creative human minds, the best in the world, the vision of a new world order, leapfrogging over the calamitous inadequacy of past and current thinking.
And the dramatic moment continues. Churchill is carrying the scene with the energy of his thinking. Charles Dickens introduces caution and another major theme, the struggle between good and evil. And I'd like to read you from the book. Dickens stands up and adopts a theatrical pose by the fireplace. One hand is in the pocket of his brown, country-colored slacks, while the other fumbles absently with the gold watch chain hanging from his lavender vest under his high-buttoned tweed jacket. His features are sharp and alive with the energy of his thoughts.
You've spoken, Mr. Churchill, he continues, with great passion about the nobility of the human species and the inevitability of its triumphant ascendancy. I agree. All my work was dedicated to the release of that virtue in the human condition. But as we all know, then no one better than you, sir, there's a darker side, and it becomes manifest in individuals whose very presence seems foreordained to bring disaster and misfortune by attacking the very heart of noble enterprise. I'm speaking, my dear friends, about the incarnation of evil. And then Dickens goes on to describe three kinds of evil that the visionaries need to beware of. First, there'll be the brutish lout, thick of skin and mean of mind, whose only thought is for himself, and with huge strength in great hams of hands, he'll not be averse to crushing the life out of a weaker party if rage and expectation incline him to it. And second, on the female side, there is the treachery of evil, boiling over with passion for vindictiveness, and erstwhile beauty shifts before the very gaze into hard lines of unremitting hostility and vengeance. But worst of all is the high priest of incarnate evil, intelligent and lithe of mind, but totally absorbed with illusions of grandeur. Himself portrayed in his mind as conquering hero, sweeping all obstacles aside as irritants to his deluded dreams of conquest. The world knows all these archetypes and the various paler shades of their distemper. They are there, irresolute, unforgiving, and unrepentant. They are the treacherous minority, mutations of the mainstream of the life force that otherwise empowers and ennobles the universe. As we move now with this grand venture, we must be wary and prepared for their emergence, lest they strike a telling blow at the heart of our enterprise. And so we have a sense that the visionaries are in for a battle ahead.
But Anne is there to remind us of the fountain of love, and this is what she says. I believe that at the heart of the human spirit is an unquenchable fountain of love. It's the one sure and enduring life force. Even those despicable mutations you have just described have the capacity to love. No tyrant or cold-blooded murderer has ever lived who wasn't touched at one time by love. It's there for us, for all the world, if we just look for it. I believe there's a great river of love coursing through all life on Earth. As we reach now for the higher levels of human consciousness that Mr. Churchill described, Then we'll learn to drink more deeply of the stream of love. When the road is hard and the going seems almost impossible, our visioneers will remember that. It'll shine in their eyes and glow in their acts, and the whole world will be moved by it. I just know that's the way it will be. Well, President Kennedy follows to remind us about courage. Des, would you read that piece?
There's no choice when it comes to great enterprise. There's only courage. Courage to take the first step. Courage to see it through no matter what. Courage to stand alone if necessary and face 100,000 hostile eyes and say, "This way we go," because any other is unacceptable.
And so now several themes are in place. Empires of the mind, Congress of the global mind, the struggle between good and evil, the power of love and of courage. And now Churchill announces a bold, audacious plan.
There's a summit conference of world leaders set for 6 months from now in April at the United Nations in New York. Most of them will be there. They'll meet to discuss and argue about all the usual things: trade, embargoes, arms reduction, pollution control. None of it will amount to any great improvement because they'll all come to the meeting from the same position. How do I get as much as possible for myself? While that kind of arguing is going on in New York, millions of lives elsewhere are destroyed through poverty, war, lack of hope, and all the rest of the sorry blight we know so well, exaggerated now by the cataclysmic coughing and wheezing of a dying environment. The task of the visioneers between now and then is to make sorties into every corner of the globe, to get a groundswell of action going, to put pressure on the leaders to make some real changes. Of course, this won't make much difference because all those people are carrying around the wrong mind frame in their heads, and they won't act differently until they think differently. That's when we play our trump card. He pauses and looks around the group for effect. Okay, Winston, laughs Kennedy. You've got our attention. What's your big play? We kidnap the leaders, Churchill says triumphantly.
What? The others are at first stunned, then excited by the idea. It's a strong finish to a powerful scene. The mentors leave you reflecting about the coming meeting of the world leaders. And this is how it sounds. It will be an extraordinary session of all the heads of state of the United Nations, convened by special invitation of the Secretary General. The purpose of the meeting, to develop fresh insights for the world of the 21st century. Well, Churchill certainly proposes to give them fresh insights, something not on the agenda. A quick trip by Silver Bridge to the Visioneering Room while the Visioneers redirect world affairs. What an absurd, bold, exciting, brilliant idea. Smiling, you relax back into your chair, gathering energy for the task that lies ahead.
That's the end of side two on this tape. Could you please go on to the next tape?
Hi, this is Jerry.
And Des.
In the present, to tell you how to proceed to hear the remainder of this recording. The scene is set for high drama, as the visioneers are sent around the world to change, in quite remarkable ways, how people think and how they act.
The stakes are high. The danger is great. But the potential rewards are awe-inspiring.
Along the way, you are about to encounter one of the most remarkable love stories in literature, featuring a modern man and a modern woman engaged in a life partnership of meaning and great achievement.
Through the structure of the story, you, the listener, are engaged as part of the action. You have a central role to play.
This is not going to be a quiet little story. You will need to be up for it.